to your
WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm Radio for Open Ears. You are listening to the newest installment of my monthly show called Reading is Funkdamental. It is a show where we talk about great books about music. My name is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. I play in a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music and Space Eater, Vapor Vespers, and I'm also a writer about music for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Pop Matters, and some other pubs. But today we're going to be talking with Steve Matteo, a great writer who is a veteran writer who has written a new book about all about the Beatles films. It's called Act Naturally, The Beatles on Film. Obviously, we know the Beatles did a lot of films, Help, Hard Day's Night, and such on. And Steve is going to take us through them and sort of put them in the context of the British film industry of the 60s, and which was fantastic. So without further ado, let's get on with the show and talk to Steve Matteo about the Beatles on film. Okay, here we are. We're here with Steve Matteo, who has written a bunch of books, but this is the fabulous one we're talking about today. Let's see. The Beatles on Film. And actually, I have to say the title is deceptive because this book is... it has a lot of context beyond the films of the Beatles. It really sets them in the context of British cinema of the 60s, which was an incredible time and even goes back there, and then really talks about the musical influences, because as much as the Beatles films are about films, they're about great albums and great tracks. So welcome, Steve. So let's start by giving us a little bit of background about yourself, your books, how you got into the Beatles, and what you've written.
Well, I've been doing this a long time, like yourself.
Right.
And our paths crossed like ships in the night. We didn't know we were both working for the same magazine at the same time, but that's right. Cool.
Yeah.
So we finally meet now.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've been writing about music, you know, for a very long time. I don't want to say how long, because then I'm going to date myself. But, you know, I've just, you know, the Beatles, just after you do this for a while, or after you listen to music for a while, you just realize they're the top. I mean, there's just nothing better. Now, of course, some people will say, well, no, it's the Rolling Stones, you know, or Led Zeppelin or the Carpenters. But so... The Beatles are great subject matter to write about. There's mm-hmm. just so much to write about. And this is my second book on the Beatles. This was my first one right here.
Right.
This is Let It Be book. And this is part of the 33 and a third series from Bloomsbury.
Great series, yeah.
Which was my second book. My first book was a biography of Bob Dylan called, get this, Dylan.
Wow.
And so, you know, imagine. Dylan and the Beatles. I mean, that's kind of...
Well, I should tell you, I'm doing this interview. I'm a quarter of a mile away from Big Pink. That's where I live.
I live in Saugerties.
Yeah. So let's get into this book because again, as I said in the setup, it is much more than film. So you really set up the context of the Beatles in relation to, you know, obviously musical trends and stuff, but really the film, the British films of the really the 50s into the 60s, you know, the kitchen sink dramas, obviously the James Bond movies will sort of have an influence here. Richard Lester, the Goon. So let's talk a little bit about that and then how the Beatles got into this arrangement with United Artists, which actually, interestingly, predates their popularity and their entry into the States. So,
right. I mean, you know, it is a film book. You know, people see the Beatles, so they assume, well, this is a book about music. It's about the Beatles, but it's about the films. And I really thought it was important to create some context. Like, they didn't just wake up one day and said, let's make a movie. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's a lot of reasons for doing this sort of thing. I mean, pop music artists going back to Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley and Cliff Richard, you know, all did stuff with movies. You know, once you reach a certain level of fame, the idea is to, back then they didn't call it this, you know, expand the brand mm-hmm. and do all these kinds of things. But when the Beatles decided that, yes, this is something we're going to do, like everything else they did, it was going to be different. It wasn't just going to be the typical pop group or pop artist in a film. And so I wanted to really, you know, I wanted to put the context in place because the Beatles films, starting with A Hard Day's Night, are really part of a huge explosion of British cinema in the 60s. And so I wanted to write a lot about that. I wanted to give people a sense of what was going on in British cinema at this time. You know, the film doesn't just happen in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. It's really a part of this whole explosion. You know, it's always been, like I've said in the book, it's, you know, Hollywood, you know, ruled film for years. And then after World War II, it started to become more of a sort of an international thing where, mm-hmm. you know, in Italy and in France, they started becoming significant in terms of being meccas for filmmakers and right. films in general. And then the England kind of came a little later. I mean, they always made great films over the years. You know, there's always right. been, you know, The Third Man, I think, was probably right. the great film maybe that's ever come out of England. And that happened, you know, pre-60s, you know, mm-hmm. just after the war. So I really wanted to write that. I didn't want it to just be one of those books of like, oh, and they made A Hard Day's Night and then they made Help. And mm-hmm. we've read all this stuff before.
Right.
It's in other books. But the other thing, too, was there really hadn't been a book on the films in a long time. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, to myself, this is a good time to do this, because with all of the years since then, since the last major book about the films, we had all these reissues of the soundtracks and these films coming out on VHS, DVD and Blu-ray and all the
and then
extra.
Obviously Peter Jackson, you know, the timing was excellent for
yeah,
his,
that was
his
coming.
Revisiting.
I mean,
yeah.
I always forget if I knew. I don't think I knew it was happening yet when
you
I saw
you reference it at the end, but it's not a deep dive into that because that's a book of its own. But but it's interesting. I mean, I love a lot of those, you know, Lindsay Anderson films. If Espresso Bongo was a Beat Girl, you mentioned all these great films. Now, so let's talk about the deal, because Brian Epstein got them into film. I guess the deal was made in late 63 with United Artists, and to the chagrin of Capitol, because United Artists got some valuable albums that Capitol did not get. So let's hear a little bit about that deal.
Well, there's sort of two things going on. On the one hand, Brian Epstein really, he's often referred to as somebody who was not good at making deals for the Beatles, that there was a lot of money left on the table, that he was not, you know, that tough right. shark in some respects. But he really pushed in the beginning and pushed Ed Sullivan and pushed United Artists, you know, in a way of saying, look, these guys are going to be the biggest thing in the world. So if you want to get on the bandwagon, do it now, because later it's going to be too late. And now how much of that was bravado, or how much of that was him really realizing that this is the next great pop, not just music phenomenon, but pop phenomenon. And so now United Artists, their attitude was, well, you know, it won't be expensive to make this film, and all we care about is we're going to get this soundtrack album. And right. as I get into great detail in the book, you know, United Artists was a film company that was very smart about soundtrack albums, about realizing how lucrative that they could be, and how it's, you know, a way of making ancillary income, not just from, not just the ticket sales from the films, but from soundtracks. And they had this great United Artists Records division.
So how did they get, how did they sort of get away with that? Was it that Capitol's contract did not cover this area, and that's how they snuck in there?
It's just one of these little things. You know, people are not thinking about all of this nowadays. If you sign a contract with anybody, you know, it's 87,000 pages long, and they cover everything. You know, even the stuff that hasn't been invented yet. So when they did the deal, they didn't think, well, what happens if a movie is made and then this company in America, or, you know, it's based in America, but they had their offices in England, then they can put out music because we don't have those particular rights.
Right.
You would think something like that, you know, they would have been on top of that, but it's this little.
Well, if Alan Klein was around, Klein wouldn't have let that one slip by.
And that's how this album happens.
Yeah.
This is the United
Artists. Well, let's talk about the albums, because as you said in the book, and I didn't really realize this doing the math, you said four of the 12 initial albums, and maybe five if you kind of throw in Yellow Submarine, were soundtrack albums.
Right. I mean, it's important. It's a major part of what they did. I mean, and they're all different in some respects. I mean, A Hard Day's Night and Help have certain similarities. Mm-hmm. But the other three films are completely different from A Hard Day's Night and Help.
Right.
I mean, Yellow Submarine, as far as a soundtrack album, is, it's somewhat of a throwaway.
Right.
You know? And then as far as Magical Mystery Tour is concerned, there was not really a soundtrack album. There was this. There was this EP that they put out in England.
Right.
And then, of course, the
That's arguably one of their greatest albums in terms of what's on it. In my opinion,
and
you know,
great,
one of my favorites
for stereo. It's got some great sound quality, and people who are super Beatle audiophile freaks will tell you that the German version of a Magical Mystery Tour, the full length album, is probably the best sounding Beatle album that exists. Just sound, judging the quality of the music.
Well, let's go back and talk. Let's start with A Hard Day's Night. Obviously, that was a Ringo, whatever you call them, came out of Ringo's mouth. And then these sharks sharpies that write songs just seized on it. And that was really very much, as were the first couple of films, product of Richard Lester. So let's talk a little bit about Richard Lester and then Hard Day's Night and its influence.
Well, I think, you know, Richard is an example of how, especially early on with the Beatles, they just seem to align themselves with the right people.
Right.
Now, things in the music business, things can go wrong real fast if you get in bed with the wrong people. And the Beatles were lucky because they got involved with Brian, and they got involved with George Martin. And then when it came time to make their films, they got involved with Richard Lester. And Lester was perfect for them because they were fans of the Goons, you know, Peter Sellers and that whole crowd. They were big fans. You know, Richard was an American, and the Beatles loved everything American. He was a very smart guy. He graduated from UPenn. Which
he was a clinical trained as a clinical psychologist, which I guess was very good for
him. That was his major. And, you know, UPenn it's an Ivy League school. Most people don't know that. They know Harvard is, you know, Princeton and Yale. And he was also a musician. I mean, he played the piano. He knew jazz. He knew classical music. And, you know, so he fit easily with them. And, you know, some people are just not going to fit with the right. Beatles. And, you know, he had worked in television and he did commercials, which, you know, now you would think, well, you know, that's not necessarily a plus. But mm-hmm. back then, particularly in England, and he was an American in England, back then, British television and British commercials were very progressive and creative and very exciting. You know, films mm-hmm. take a long time to make, but, mm-hmm. you know, television is often, it's live, or, you know, commercials, they had a lot of creativity back then. So he brought all of this stuff to the making of A Hard Day's Night.
Well, and that really took, that filming began when they got back, correct, from the first sort of, you know, United States blitz. So, right. you know, they were probably busier than they ever was. So what was the kind of, it was kind of Marx Brothery type film. What was the sort of premise about it? And then talk about some of the cast, the memorable,
What happened was the person who ended up writing the screenplay, Alan Owen, he was tasked with just go and hang out with the Beatles. So he went to, I believe it was Scotland when they were still on tour, and he just hung out with them just to see what it was like being with them. And he was from Liverpool. He was a playwright. So he understood the Liverpudlian personality and culture, the place that they came from. And he was able to, you know, hang out with them and see what's it like. I mean, the whole thing of the movie, the joke of, you know, from a train to a stage to a TV studio, mm-hmm. you know, to a hotel room. I mean, that was
life.
What they were living.
Yeah.
And so he was able to sort of capture that. And there is a certain amount of it that is improvised. I think over the years, people have thought that maybe it's more improvised than it actually was.
Right. That's because he was so into the character. He understood the character.
Right. Now, the characters are sort of, they are John, Paul, George, and Ringo, but they're not.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And the people around them are just, they're more like archetypes. They're not necessarily exactly, you know, Brian or Mal. Right. You know, that's not, you know, Neil. They're not those people.
Right.
They're totally different, but they're like archetypes of the manager, the roadie, the road manager, you know, that sort of, the press conference was like a real press conference.
Right.
I mean, they used actual people from the media to do that. So it's a blend of fact and fiction. It's like a sort of pseudo documentary, and it looks like
right. it. And that's funny, really, without, you know, there's some interesting facts you had here that I believe he thought that, strangely, he thought that McCartney was the worst actor, and he believed that Harrison was the best actor. And George,
right.
actually, as everybody probably knows by now, he met his wife, Patty, on that.
Right.
I was not aware that Phil Collins was one of the little dirty faced kids or something in this film.
Yes, he's
and then
in
also
the Scala Theater segment where they're.
And that Jimmy Page played on the score, correct? The George.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah,
the George Martin music.
So at the same time they're doing this, they were concurrently also trying to get together an album for this, which was the first album where it was all their original compositions, correct?
That's how it ended up, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they consciously knew that was going to be the case. Mm-hmm. But yes, this becomes their first album of their all original Lennon and McCartney songs. And I mean, I think that's a lot of why it's such a great album. And it really
right.
does. It holds up very well, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so the reaction to this film was then and now was excellent.
Yes.
Great reviews. Hugely influential. You interviewed some very interesting people in the book, Cameron Crowe, you know, talking about how influential this was. Without this movie, there would not be the Monkees television show. so that was kind of it. So this was a big success. And then I guess immediately they were like, let's make another one. So they decide to make another one, which is called Help, the final title. And that really is kind of influenced by two things, James Bond movies, right? It has that. And all of a sudden, thanks to your man, Bob Dylan, you wrote a book about him. At the Delmonico Hotel, he did a wonderful thing for music. He introduced the Beatles to marijuana, purportedly.
Right.
So let's talk about that film.
The Pleasures of Tea. Yes.
The Pleasures of Tea.
Yes.
And that was also really, I guess it was a way for them to take a break and go to, as you say, exotic locations. So they were in where?
Right.
Bahamas, Austria.
Right. It was filmed in the Bahamas. I mean, see, we should just back up a second.
Yeah, sure.
I'll just say one quick thing and then relate to what you just said. Some people have suggested that Dylan didn't turn them on. It wasn't their first, by the way. And I talk about that, you know, just because I wanted to be clear. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a critic.
Right.
You know, I'm not a guy who's analyzing.
Right.
You know, I'm more interested in what happened. Nobody cares about my opinion. I will occasionally offer it, you know, but I'm more interested in, you know, the reality of it, because these things become apocryphal. You know, Bob Dylan turned the Beatles onto pot, and then it's like, that's it, case closed.
Right.
And maybe not the case, or maybe one or two of them had already tried it, but the rest of them didn't. So maybe it was the first time somebody turned them all onto it. To talk about, you know, filming in exotic locations, this is a reflection of the James Bond films.
Right.
Because that was one of the things that, you know, really made the Bond films so interesting. We forget that, you know, the first Bond film came out in 1962.
Yeah.
So we forget that at that time, most people didn't just jump on a plane and go to Paris or Morocco or whatever. It was, you know, air travel, international air travel for the average person was still very new. And so one of the things about the Bond films that people loved is you could see these incredible places that, you know, maybe you would never see in your whole life. Now, of course, the world has changed now and we all travel and we've all been everywhere. But so they took a page from that and, you know, that's what they did. So they filmed in the Bahamas. They filmed in Austria. They, of course, still filmed in England. And some people have suggested, and I talk about this in the book, that part of the reason they did it in the Bahamas was it was a tax dodge, is they had this tax shelter there. One of their tax people said, we're going to do part of this here because then we can write a certain amount of money off. So basically nothing has changed in the world.
Right.
So, but I mean, it is the contrast of it is it's really interesting, you know, and it's weird because if I have this right, I think they were in the Bahamas first. See, it's been so long now since I've written the book.
No, I think you said then they went to Austria.
Sorry.
Then they went to Austria. Then they went to Austria. Yeah.
Right. And so when they're in Austria, they've got these tans. So they're in this place in the snow and they've got tans because they were just in the Bahamas. So, I mean, the locales is what it's kind of what makes it. It's interesting, and it's different, and it's very James Bond.
Yeah, well, for a personal diversion, here's what happened to me. The day this movie went out, I lived in Queens, and I went, I think, for the 9 a.m. showing at a theater in Fresh Meadows. I watched it five straight times. My mother called the police. She thought I was kidnapped. So I just soaked in this movie more so than, you know, than any of the others in terms of just seeing it like five times in a row. There's also another interesting thing here that this is how George sort of was introduced to the sitar, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you want to tell that story.
They're being chased by this cult. Okay.
Right.
And let's just say this. Some of the sort of stereotypes in this film
very,
are now considered politically incorrect. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the nature of this was 1964, 1965.
Right.
Okay. So they're in this Indian restaurant and there's a scene that's filmed there and they use actual Indian musicians playing Indian music. And so George saw, I believe it was a sitar, and he was just fascinated by this instrument. And that began his interest in it. But he has also said over the years that his mother had listened to Indian music. And so this was something that was like, literally, he was receiving these vibrations in the womb.
Really? Wow.
It wasn't completely new to him.
Huh.
You know, or maybe he didn't know about this until later, or it didn't dawn on him, or he didn't realize it until later. And so, of course, he gets all into the music, but the culture, too, the Indian culture, too. He becomes very interested in in Indian religion.
And that, so they were always concurrently working on the films and the music at the same time? Was it kind of like aside from, let's say, Yellow Submarine, where they just move stuff in?
In the book, one of the things I try to do is give like a timeline of things. Mm-hmm. So usually the way these things work is they're always kind of jumping around.
Right.
And there's times when they're making a movie, but they might write a song. Or like they might decide, oh, let's go in a studio. But obviously, when they were in the Bahamas and when they were in Austria, there was no opportunity to go into a recording studio. Like mm-hmm. that wasn't a thing. I do believe though, like when they were on tour in Paris early on, they did use recording studios in Paris, and I think they recorded some of the sort of foreign language versions.
Yeah, the foreign language versions of things. Yeah.
So. They just were in constant motion all the time.
What were some of your, let's talk about the first two films. What are some of your, if you can, what are some of your favorite scenes from them?
I'm one of these kind of people that, you know, I walk around all the time, you know, spewing lines from movies, you know, and it's often movies from, you know, A Hard Day's Night. You know, so, and sometimes, you know, I drive my wife crazy with this stuff, but sometimes she sets me up. Like I'll get out of the shower and she'll say, so are you all clean right now? And I'll say, I'm really quite clean, you know, he's really quite clean, boy. You know? So, you know, it's more like these lines, not so much necessarily scenes, although I love the sort of the performance scenes.
Those are great. Which one was it A Hard Day's Night where they all lived in the contiguous apartments and Lennon, I was very jealous. Lennon had the sunken, like the bed sunk in
right,
the living room.
Right.
Was
right,
that Hard Day's Night?
No, that's actually Help.
That's Help. So from there, let's move into Magical Mystery Tour. What I like about this is as you did with the British film, setting up the lead into A Hard Day's Night, you do a really nice, you know, sort of mini backgrounder on psychedelia, on the history of, you know, sort of psychedelic music and fashion, starting with, you know, the Charlatans, you know, at the Red Dog, Pink Floyd. Here's where we get into acid, Michael Hollingshead. So this movie is the one that, you know, probably was the most maligned over time for some reasons, which seems to be getting a bit of a rehab in recent years. And then again, as we said earlier, the album that came out of Magical Mystery Tour has some of their greatest stuff on it. So let's talk about, so how did they get it? How did Magical Mystery Tour develop? And, you know, it seemed to be a Paul project. How did he come up with it? And this was sort of in the absence of
Brian.
Brian Lang.
Right. I mean, like you said too, you know, I thought it was important, like, you know, people hear psychedelic and they're like, oh yeah, Pink Floyd was a psychedelic band. Well, you know, there's more to this year. So I wanted to give some real background over psychedelic drugs and who were the people who were the sort of avatars of this. Mm-hmm. And again, when I wrote it, you know, we're not condoning, we're not condemning, mm-hmm. we're just recording history. And I wanted people to realize mm-hmm. that this music comes from this place of people mm-hmm. experimenting with new lifestyles and drugs. And it is a reflection of that. Mm-hmm. And the Beatles, they were both influential in terms of psychedelic music, but they were heavily influenced by psychedelic music. There were people who were making psychedelic music long before 1967.
Right, you know? Right.
So I thought that was important, you know, to do that. And the clothes and other films and other groups. I mean, you know, Pink Floyd and the Soft Machine were really ahead of the Beatles. And in England, like anytime there was a psychedelic thing, those two bands were kind of always there.
Right.
They were like the two soundtrack bands. And so they knew at some point they had to make another movie. They owed United Artists one more film.
Didn't they have a 4-picture deal?
No, it was a 3-picture deal.
Oh, okay.
That's how it started. And I can explain all that.
All right. No, that's okay.
I explained it in the book. It's kind of complicated. So they knew at some point they were going to do a third film. So after Brian died, I mean, they were kind of at wit's end, you know. They had done Pepper, and they were all kind of a little bit going in their own direction a little bit. And, you know, after you do something like Sergeant Pepper, it becomes this situation of like, what do you do next? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you top the mountain, you know? And so there was a sense of them fragmenting. And I think Paul, he had this idea to do this film because he was getting into avant-garde film and, you know, avant-garde music. And he was just very creative. He was the one spending most of his time in London, where the others were sort of married and living in the suburbs,
right,
for lack of a better word. And so he got this idea on a flight. And I think partially he wanted to, like, we all need to be together. And he knew that if they didn't have a next project,
something to do,
all sink their collective teeth into, who knows what could happen. I don't think that they would have broken up, but it could have been a while, you know, since they did something else.
And this
This
is the film that was largely improvised. According to your book, Paul made a circle and did it into 8 sections, which would be various scenes. I guess there was a bit of, I don't know if it predated it or postdated it, but Ken Kesey and his Merry Prankster Bus, you know, and right. These bus trips, these mystery tours were a British institution. You know, you'd show up and they'd say, get on the bus and we're not going to tell you where you're going. So that really was an inspiration. It has some great scenes. Paul's Fool on the Hill, obviously the famous I Am the Walrus, which was shot at the military, which was lovingly parodied in The Ruddles, which may be the greatest bit of British Beatles film of all time.
Yep.
But
it lasted longer than a lunch hour.
That's right. But it's so, you know, they did this film journeying around, improvising things. It was kind of hit and miss in terms of the quality of various scenes. There's a sort of Benny Hill influence, I think I read somewhere in here. But it comes out, it's the day after Christmas, Boxing Day, and they put it on television. This psychedelic splash of color is put on TV in black and white. And it is the Beatles' first failure, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. And that's the problem, is the day after Christmas, people are hungover, or it's family-oriented entertainment, not a psychedelic freak out. And people are watching this, you know, widescreen color thing happening on TV screens that are smaller than the laptops both you and I are on right now.
Right.
So, you know, that's part of the sort of failure of it. One of the great things about the film, it's a television show. They didn't know it was going to be a TV show.
Right.
Is that just the way you described it? It's the old fashioned British, let's jump in a bus and go on a mystery tour. And then it's also Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. Mm-hmm. So they're taking something that's part of their culture that's been around for a while, something that's stood the test of time, and then they're kind of spiking it with their new way of doing things.
Right.
I mean, that's what they did with, that's what Sergeant Pepper was.
Yeah.
I mean, Sergeant Pepper was the same thing. It's all of this dance hall music and all of this orchestrated music and, you know, harps, and but then it's just completely psychedelic, and all the experimentation that went on, and it's a concept album and all of that. And that's the genius of the Beatles.
Right. Well, also, I get a sense of a Fellini sensibility in some of it, like that scene where they're shoveling the pasta, you know, and even the way they cast it, you know, Fellini just cast people that, you know, certainly were, let's just say they look singular. So now, as a way to say, you know, how it was not quite as successful, there was no US TV sale. Nobody wanted it at that time, right?
Well, that was originally what it was supposed to be. I believe it was going to be shown by NBC. And then when they saw what this thing was, they said, yeah, we're not showing this.
Yeah. So then they're kind of done with film, essentially. And then what comes is Yellow Submarine, which.
Right. But one thing you need to know that's clear, they had a 3-picture deal. And so Magical Mystery Tour, even though it was distributed by United Artists, I believe, or they had some involvement with it, is that was not going to be the third film in the deal.
They didn't want
and
it.
And that's why they decided to do Yellow Submarine to complete the three-picture deal. And actually, that's the one that, even though it was distributed by United Artists, it did not fulfill the contract because it was an animated film and the Beatles were only in it at the end. Right. And the contract, I think, stipulated that, you know, this has got to be a Beatles movie, not a movie with Beatles music in it.
Right. Well, that was, as you say, that was sort of this guy Brodax, who did the Beatles cartoons, which he did 39 episodes. And, you know, as you say in the book, that led to like the Brady Kids and all these various animated. So interesting backstory. It's a beautiful piece of art, Yellow Submarine. And the music is, you know, there were some, maybe not as much attention put on the music as other out, you know, certainly as Help or, but still has some great stuff in it. And this is kind of a Homeric tale, as you say. Eric Siegel, Love Story, was one of the writers, I believe.
One of the many.
One of the many writers. So tell us a little bit about the reaction to this. So they really weren't very involved in it. They come in the end of the film, right? Like, you know, for 2 minutes.
I mean, what happens is, they want nothing to do with this thing. They just, great. We'll give you 4 songs. They're throwaways. And just, we fulfill the contract and we move on and we're done with being in movies. And, you know, especially after Magical Mystery Tour didn't go well, they just figured we're done. Mm-hmm. So what happens is they see what this is going to look like in progress. And they're impressed with it. They really like it. Yeah. They think it's really good. It is well done. Yeah. There's no question about it. It's brilliant. And I interviewed some of the people that actually worked on it, which was great. Mm-hmm. And there's a book by a guy named Bob Hieronymus. There's actually 2 books. Mm. And he writes in great detail about the making of Yellow Submarine. Yeah. And him and his team were very helpful for me when I was writing that segment of the book.
Yeah, my first job out of college was I worked for a cel animation company.
Oh.
And so I knew, I mean, I would get dragged in to paint like 80 shoes on cels, you know. Behind a very incredibly labor intensive.
Yes,
it really is. It's such a fantastic, you know, like I say, piece of art. How was the critical reaction to that?
I mean, people did like it. I mean, you know, the people who got it. And I mean, basically at the time there was no such thing as an animated feature film for adults. It just didn't exist. Everything was made for children. And it was mostly by Disney. And it would often take at least 3 years to make one of these films. And the people who made Yellow Submarine, they did it in a year, which is incredible.
A staff of 200, I believe you said?
I believe so. Yeah. It's really a great story. And, you know, I went into it in a certain amount of detail, but nothing, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, create a commercial here for Bob Hieronymus, but that he owns Yellow Submarine, what he wrote about it. I mean, I give a more condensed version for somebody who doesn't want to read, you know, 600 or 700 pages on it. So it is a task that, you know, the people that made it and many of them had already been involved in the world of animation and would go on to do other incredible things.
Talk about that. Yeah, you talk about Ralph Bakshi in the book, the guy who did Fritz the Cat and all those.
Right, I talked to him because, I mean, he was the guy who sort of made a career out of making feature-length animated films for adults, and in some cases, they were very adult.
Yeah,
his films.
Well, this was the Zap. This was the Zap comic era.
Right.
Whenever I look at any of that stuff, I get like a retro pie. I don't smoke anymore, but I just...
There was all these people that were doing this kind of thing.
Yeah. Underground comics.
I mean, Crumb is, you know, our Crumb is an important figure still around today. I mean, you know, he's not a guy who associates himself with the hippie thing, though.
Oh, no,
he's,
no.
He's not into
like
the
old
hippie
school, like, Victrola guy.
Into, Right. He's like, right. He's into like 78s from the 20s. Yeah. He's so not
one,
a hit.
One thing before we move on this film that I did not realize is there was a discussion of a remake in 2012 with Disney, which was news to me. So,
right. Which would have been terrible.
Totally. I mean, I think this is something that can't, you know, be replicated. It's kind of like Sergeant Pepper. You know, everybody tried to do a Sergeant Pepper and none of it really worked.
And I didn't know anything about this until I started doing research.
Yeah. Wow. Look,
I mean, I was pretty deep in and I found out about this and I was like, I had no idea that. I mean, this was really close to being greenlighted and made into a film. You know, Bob Zemeckis is a major filmmaker. And I mean, they were really going to do this. This was going to really be a thing. Yeah. And they were going to try to do it. I believe it was going to be like a Disney kind of thing. You know, yeah. Who knows?
Well, we should, you know, now we're going to move into the final Beatle film. And speaking of something that got remade in a great way, Let It Be. You wrote a book about this for the 33 and a third series. So Let It Be. Let's discuss that. I mean, what ultimately ended up happening was not necessarily what they wanted to happen, right? They wanted to do a concert in a Greek amphitheater in Libya or wherever. So tell us about Let It Be and, you know, where it fits into the sort of Beatle universe of film.
Let It Be is this thing, okay? You know, when I was asked, you know, I contacted the people at Bloomsbury and found out about this 33 and a third series before the first book even came out.
Wow.
And they were like, okay, sure. You know, we'd love to have you write a book. And they wanted me to do Bob Dylan. And I said, well, I kind of did Dylan already. I'd rather do something else. So they're like, okay, what do you want to do? I said, how about the Beatles? And they said, okay, great. We don't have a Dylan book. We don't have a Beatles book. When I told them I wanted to do Let It Be, I think they were a little surprised. But the reason I wanted to do it, and that book came out 20 years ago, okay? Right. The reason I wanted to do it was because everything connected to Let It Be is an amazing story.
True.
It's just incredible. I mean, the bootlegs that came out from it. You know, everybody talks about Bob Dylan bootlegs, but, you know, the Great White Wonder, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. But really, the bootlegs for Get Back, not Let It Be, really. The bootlegs for Get Back are what really, to me, kicked open the bootleg industry.
Right.
And what they're from is when you make a movie, or in the old days anyway, you had these Nagra tape recorders that would sync with the 35 millimeter film, and they're excellent quality. And so one of the people who worked on the film, they told me that we were told that with all the equipment, audio and video, as soon as one Beatle showed up for the day, you start filming and you start recording sound.
Right.
And you don't stop until the last Beatle leaves. So they have, you know, hours and hours and hours of them talking and playing and jamming and all of this.
And that's really the terra firma that made it possible for Peter Jackson to do what Jackson did.
Jumping ahead.
But the initial concept was, you know, this is going to be the Beatles. They're going to be, you know, you're going to film them at a studio, getting together, writing songs, and then it's going to culminate in this concert, which is going to be at some, you know, like Floyd and Pompeii or on a cruise ship or whatever. So that didn't go quite the way it was.
No. You know, no one knows really what it is. Did they decide, well, we're going to do a concert and film it, or are we going to make an album? The way that I kind of reconstructed it twice, because I wrote one whole book on it and then part of another, is they wanted to play live because after they did the Hey Jude video, which was mostly live, they enjoyed it so much and they missed performing. So they said, great, let's play live.
And was that Michael Lindsay Hogg too, who did that?
Michael did that.
I love one of my favorite music videos ever is his Child of the Moon, Rolling Stone.
Oh, yeah, for the Rolling Stones.
Oh, I love that. And I love that song, but go ahead.
Yes.
Sorry.
So they decided, okay, so if we're going to play live, we're going to have to rehearse. Okay, so let's film it. And then they were filming that and then talking about, well, where are we going to play? And, you know, at some point, I'm condensing a lot here. George Harrison said, I'm fed up with this. What are we doing? I'm done. Goodbye. Yeah. And so long
See
story
you in the
short,
clubs.
Right. So long story short, George kind of agreed, all right, I'll come back, but let's make an album and then we'll figure out whether we're going to play or not. So let's record songs. Let's actually be doing something here. Okay. And so then the idea of where are we going to play live? Cause that was still part of it. And again, I'm condensing,
yeah, you're condensing everything
is, well, let's just go up on the roof and play.
Right.
And that creates the end of the movie too. That gives Michael Lindsay Hogg, the director,
Drama.
A chance to come up with something. And I interviewed, it was great because I got to interview Michael for the Let It Be book. Mm-hmm. And then for this book. So like all these years go by and I get to talk to him again. And he's just an amazing individual. Right. He's so creative. He's also a painter. He's royalty. People don't know this. He's right. actually royalty. And he was one of the directors of Ready, Steady, Go. He did Brideshead Revisited.
Right.
I mean, he's a filmmaker. He's an extraordinary guy. So then, you know, let's fast forward to Let It Be Naked. Paul never liked the Let It Be album. He never liked what Phil Spector did with it.
Well, right there, we'll say the original was, it was being recorded by Glenn Johns, produced by Glenn Johns originally.
With a little help from George. From George Martin. And Alan Parsons was there. Alan Parsons.
And then as Glenn says in your book, Spector puked all over it.
Right.
Basically, he went in 7 days. He added the strings to, you know, the syrupy strings to Long and Winding Road, which I kind of like, actually. But, you know.
I do, too.
Be it as it may.
I do, too.
Paul, this was the one that they just kept fiddling with forever. So, Paul, let's jump to Let It Be Naked.
So he does. They reissue Let It Be Naked, which is they go back and they try to sort of take out all the stuff and just make it a straight album. And then they give us this disc of like a couple of minutes each of these outtakes. That was, to me, Let It Be Naked was a totally missed opportunity. Thankfully, Peter Jackson decides to make a documentary about a documentary about Let It Be called Get Back. And we get this series, which I only think the only reason we got this long series was because he kept going back and fiddling with it because he had the time to do it because it was during COVID. And this was actually the same thing I was going through with my book where the deadline kept changing and I just kept researching and writing. So it's interesting. And then we get this incredible Let It Be box set, also the audio of Let It Be, where we get a nice album, vinyl album of one of Glenn's mixes of what Get Back was supposed to be.
He did he did turn it in and it was turned down. And that's when
there were several.
Lennon brought in, you know, Phil Spector. But, you know, the thing is, these are the dark and light versions. You know, unfortunately, the version of Let It Be that went out really, you know, it came out after the album that was recorded after it. It was the last thing they did when, you know, Paul was announcing his soloing and whatever. But, you know, it reinforced the bummer side. This was like guys, they were kind of cranky. They didn't really want to do this, whatever. They're coming. It's a band coming apart. Whereas the Peter Jackson one, which is much longer, it was three hour. Yeah, it's like 8 or 9 hours.
It's 8 hours.
Yeah. It's, you know, it shows them being friendly and productive and
in parts. It's like you said. We're getting the full picture. I think Let It Be the film. It's just kind of a bummer. It's the end of the Beatles. It's dark. It's most of it is at Twickenham. We don't get a lot of Apple, you know, where the Apple segments, we didn't realize this until Peter showed it.
Right.
It was well lit and it looked like it was, you know, daylight or whatever the case may be.
And it was more convivial. What he put in their behavior with each other. Whereas at Twickenham, it was filmed right after Christmas in a, you know, a cold studio, you know, a giant
big sound stage.
Room, big sound stage. They're freezing their asses off. And, you know, of course they're going to be unhappy. And that's, like you said, George quits and then he comes back. And, So what were the responses to both of them? I know you didn't really write about the Peter Jackson that much, but how did they both?
I was able to see it. I did write about it. When you get to this point in a book, it becomes like, the editors are like, this is turning into the director's cut here. This book was originally going to be 200 pages and it was going to be written in like a year or two. And instead it was more like 4 years and it's close to 350 pages.
You don't want to leave anything out.
This is what writers do. You're so afraid that if you don't say L and R, people, how could you leave that out? So you can't win. Then as people say, well, what is all this extra stuff about the movies? I thought this was a book about the Beatles. You can't keep the customer satisfied.
I don't think anybody's got a brain would have that reaction to it.
We don't live in a reading culture.
Oh no.
So people want, they want nuggets of sound bites. And I tried, I'm a journalist, I try to be sort of almost like a historian and you want to be accurate. And if you need 50 pages to be accurate, where 10 isn't going to cut it, this is always a push pull with this sort of thing. You don't want to put people to sleep, but I want to tell the whole story. This story has not been told in a long time, the movies of the Beatles. And it's so significant to who they were and their time together. And it, it bookends the 60s. It's kind of like, from the 60s, obviously for some people begins when John Kennedy is assassinated. And it ends sometime in the early 70s or even later. Some people have said the 60s ended when John Lennon was assassinated. So I wanted to give the full picture. But of course, what I did was, when I got to Rubber Soul, I can't spend a lot of time on this. So Rubber Soul, Revolver, and Sgt. Pepper, they're probably their three best albums. There's very little about it in my book. Because those three albums have nothing to do with the films, but you have to put that connective tissue in there if you're writing a linear.
And I should say, it really does cover their entire, productivity musically, albums-wise. That, everything is really in there, in terms of, the milestones of, the dentist turning him on to, what, and so it all is complete. But what I was getting at is the initial version, the funeral version with the black cover and all that, that was not trashed. Critically, it was trashed. That's was another trashed. One I went and saw five times in a row. But, the Peter Jackson one, it came out during the height of COVID. Everybody was home. We needed something to cheer us up.
Thanksgiving weekend.
It was the anti-Tiger King or whatever that was, that show. It was, so it came out, Thanksgiving. So they did it right this time. So again, this is a great book. If you want to let us know what anything else you're working on now or what do you have coming down the pike in terms of your writing?
I mean, I write regularly for the Vinyl District. They mostly cover vinyl. There's a surprise. I'm in there every week. I write a lot about reissues from the 60s and 70s, mostly vinyl, the box sets, mostly rock, some jazz and, R&B and soul and other kinds of music and folk or whatever the case may be. I mean, that's the main sort of musical thing that I do. I'm also on the radio. I've been doing a program in New York on WUSB.
Yes, Stony Brook.
It's a show. It's a news and public affairs show, and I've been sort of the contributing kind of media and analyst guy. And trying to make some sense of the media that we live in, particularly during the Trump years, and that's as political as I will get here because vibrations are so good here between me and Sal talking about the Beatles in New York. And I'm always doing
different things. You're going to light the fuse on my derangement syndrome. I just warn you. So I want to leave the listeners with one thing. Why don't you rate them in terms of which are your favorites or which are the ones you would recommend people see in what order and why?
I'll just say one thing about them before that. So sure. Believe it or not, Richard Lester's favorite movie of the two that he did is Help, not A Hard Day's Night. No. He just had more fun with it. And he loved the color photography, the person who was right. the cinematographer. He just loved what he did. He felt that was a breakthrough in color photography on film. Right. For me personally, I mean, A Hard Day's Night, I mean, it's like your first child. You right. know? I mean, there's nothing of all their films. There's nothing quite like that. It is just so much there happening as a movie, musically, the Beatles. You feel like you're there in London. It just feels incredible. Mm-hmm. It never gets tired. It's just, you know, completely timeless. I like Help a lot because I'm a big Bond fan. I'm a big fan of British spy films of the 60s. So I can kind of, you know, check my brains at the door and kind of let some of the political correctness kind of go by. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a person who is politically correct. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of let it go by. It doesn't really bother me. It looks great. You know what I mean? It looks really great. It's a great looking film, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, Yellow Submarine still is, it does hold up really well.
Yeah.
So that and Help would be my second, you know, favorite after A Hard Day's Night. It depends on the day of the week.
Okay.
I think Magical Mystery Tour over the years for me, I've grown to like it more because I realize that it becomes influential on music videos because it's almost like a collection of music videos in some ways. And the music is so great and it is kind of trippy and psychedelic. And I do like things that are trippy and psychedelic. I love psychedelic music. It's one of my favorite kinds of music, especially as you get more and more obscure into it, you know? So I do like that. I think Let It Be is probably my least favorite because it is just so dark and depressing. I mean, it has some great songs on it. I love the rooftop sequence.
Right.
I mean, it's great. And now we have this Get Back series, which is like an adjunct to it. I consider them, you know, two together. They sort of, they're together. That's kind of how I look at it. Yeah. And so I think probably, unfortunately, Let It Be is always going to be kind of the runt of the litter.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, I agree with your sequence. I really like Yellow Submarine because I played it a lot with my kids. My daughter would just like, you know, wake me up at 3 in the morning.
It is great.
That or 1001 Dalmatians. So thanks for joining me. This is Steve Matteo. The book is called Act Naturally, The Beatles on Film. He's also written the 33 and a third book about Let It Be. That's a great series. And Dylan on Dylan. There it is. Well, till next book.